Well, during our coffee break, a couple of really good illustrations came up in our informal discussion. For the sake of our friends who may be listening by tape, I want to just mention them in quick passing. We had an illustration of how a text can be terribly misinterpreted according to the author's intention, even though the interpretation is theologically accurate and wholesome. And that is what Campus Crusade, and oh, it's not just Campus Crusade, any number of evangelists and evangelistic organizations will use the text in Revelation 3 where Jesus says, "I stand at the door and knock, if any man, you know, will open, I'll come in to him," and so forth, as though that were an evangelistic text, a call to people to become Christians in the first place, rather than, as it was in the original, an address to those who had already professed faith. And secondly, used as though what it means is you've got to, by your own exercise of will, let Jesus in. So it's not a matter of who he chooses, but a matter of who chooses him. And then you'll have people who will use that as a call to come down the aisle, you know, because that's how you let Jesus into your heart. And on it goes. Well, it is true that we're supposed to let Jesus into our hearts. Okay. Now, it's also true we can't do that unless he enables us to, but it is true we're supposed to affirm our allegiance and follow him and so forth. But the difficulty is this text doesn't teach that. So that's a good illustration of what we were getting at earlier, where you have a theologically accurate conclusion, but an abuse of the Bible to support it. Why not go to texts that actually teach the theology that is true? And then we had another illustration while we were talking informally of how people will go and look at the meaning of, say, the names in a genealogy and get the gospel out of it. Adam, would you repeat that for us?
Yeah, it's as if the genealogy, which is mentioned in Genesis 5 and it's recounted in 1 Chronicles in a more abbreviated form, is a coded message. Adam, which can mean man, Seth means appointed, Enosh is mortal, Canaan is sorrow, Mahalalel is the blessed God, Jared is shall come down, Enoch can be teacher or teaching, and Methuselah his death shall bring, Lamech would be despair or despairing, and Noah's rest. So put that together and fill it in a little bit, and you've got man is appointed mortal sorrow, but the blessed God shall come down teaching, that his death shall bring the despairing rest. And so, you know, God snuck the gospel in back in Genesis chapter 5.
Okay, now let's ask ourselves whether that could possibly be the intention of the text or the wider number of texts in which these genealogies are found. In the first place, the conclusion of it all, when it's brought together, as Adam gave it back to us, was given to us in English. Isn't that interesting? In English syntax. Well, as a matter of fact, English and Greek and Hebrew syntax are different. That is, where you find the subject of the sentence and the verb and the object is not, but it came out in English syntax from Hebrew names. Now that should make us smile and be a little suspicious to begin with. But even more than that, even if we forget about that problem, you'll notice that the syntax has been totally imposed upon the order of these names, in the sense that the grammatical function of the name is imposed. It's not something that's evident, not anything you could get from the text itself. The part that struck me is teaching.
Yeah, Enoch, teaching Methuselah, his death shall bring.
Shall bring what now?
Lamech, which means despair.
There you go.
So meaning the people are just looking for a way to get saved, and they're despairing because of that.
Yes. So his teaching shall bring those who are despairing, rest.
Right.
But now you have to take despairing there, notice, as the indirect object rather than the quality of the object. Teaching rest, or that what? How does it
teaching go? The despairing rest.
Okay,
that his death will bring, that is teaching that his death will bring the despairing rest.
Okay, now why isn't that his death will bring rest, which is despairing? That is, it's the quality of the rest. Or why isn't it that his death will bring despair? Okay, the whole point is, even if you've got a series of words here in Hebrew, forget the fact it turns out to be an English order of mention, but if you have a series of words, you still have to decide what their syntactical and grammatical function is, and that's all imposed from outside. Well, I don't want to take any more time on it, but I thought those were good illustrations of how we're not following proper procedure, even when we've got orthodox conclusions, and we are guilty of abusing the text. Okay, we're making a major change in our course at this juncture. Let me rehearse for you what we've done quickly. The introduction to this course was our call for hermeneutical concern, explanation of what hermeneutics and exegesis are. Our first unit was on language and meaning, or what we call general hermeneutics. Our second unit, or section, was why is biblical hermeneutics necessary and how is proper interpretation possible? And then I have given something of a summary of that material, as well as encountering modern errors and heresies in our third unit, a proposed Reformed confession regarding hermeneutics. This finishes now our groundwork lectures. These lectures are not systematic, they are not exhaustive by any means, and they must be supplemented by the required reading. And of course, there's more than that you can do as well, but please remember that the reading is there to give you even more insight than what I've been able to offer. But now we're going to move on from the groundwork lectures to the exegetical part of the class. That'll be the middle section, and then the last portion of the class will be hermeneutics. And so we come to Unit 4, then, in my material, and Unit 4 is tools for exegesis. Tools for this technical task of determining the meaning of the text. And I'm going to list for you 20 different kinds of tools and say a little bit about the use of each one as we go through. You can consider this something of a checklist of what you need to do if you're going to be a faithful exegete. What are the sorts of things that you ought to take into account? Maybe do some reading in or checking of if you're going to have all of the insights necessary to handle the text properly. Though there may be something of a general logical order of presentation, I don't believe that you can so rigidly lay down the style or steps of doing exegesis that you've got to do it in just this order through these 20 things. It may be that if you're dealing with the text, you might start, you know, at number 5 and then jump to 17 and go back to 1. I mean, maybe that wouldn't be very rational, but the point is, all of these deal with things you need to take into account. And very likely there's a good order in the progress through 1 through 20 that I'll give you, but I don't want you to take it as some kind of a rigid, prescribed, this is the one and only way to do it. But there are 20 different kinds of resource materials that you should be taking into account as you do the exegesis of a text. For bibliographical help on the particular books and publications that are available and recommended, let me remind you that you should, in your textbooks, look at pages 117 to 120, very helpful discussion. Kaiser has one page, page 147, where he lists the number of resources that you'll find helpful. And then all of chapter 4 in Gordon Fee's book on New Testament exegesis goes through the bibliography of materials that are available and that you might think about picking up for yourself. Since they have done it and they know that much better than I do and are more up to date than I would be, I'm not going to try to give you what my recommendations are. So don't take any of the particular books that I pick up in this next show and tell part of my lecture as necessarily saying, okay, here's the one you need. Well, maybe it is, and maybe there are better ones. Okay? So what are the 20 sorts of things that you should be looking at? What are the tools that are available for you for exegesis? First of all, translation comparisons. Translation comparisons. It may be that you know Greek and Hebrew so well that you don't need to use an English text at all. That's not true of most people, even most pastors, not even necessarily true of most seminary professors. They tend to use English translations for a good portion of their work just because it saves time. But the fact of the matter is, what is authentic for establishing doctrine is the original languages, Greek and Hebrew. It's well known that at the study center, those who are trying to earn a master's degree are not required to pass a test in Greek and Hebrew. There's a reason for that. In the first place, I've done all that. I've jumped through all the hoops. I forget how many years of Greek and so forth. I tested out of it when I got to seminary and got fairly good. I don't know if they were top. I can't remember, but I got good grades in all my language work, Hebrew and Greek. But not everybody did. But everybody graduated on time. What does that mean? That means they got through seminary hobbling along with a little bit of Greek and Hebrew they learned in the first few months or the first year that they were there. My guess is the vast majority of them did not continue after their graduation to pull out the Greek and Hebrew every time they prepared a sermon. I mean, I saw the way they handled it and how difficult it was, and I just know there's not enough time for a person to do that. Now, it would be preferable if they did. It'd also be preferable if none of us ever ate junk food, you know, and always got, you know, 8 hours sleep and all those sorts of things. So, yeah, granted, that's a wonderful ideal, but it's an impractical ideal. Most of God's people, even most of God's servants who are ordained, are not going to work exclusively in the original languages. And that's why we talk about translation comparisons, first of all, and why I'm willing to see men pursue their studies for the pastorate, even though they are not competent in Greek and Hebrew in and of themselves. What is necessary is a working knowledge of Greek and Hebrew so that you can use the technical reference tools that are available. Okay? And so that's what we're going to be going through here, is I'm going to be showing you, even if you don't know Greek and Hebrew, how you can nevertheless do fairly good exegesis. It'll be harder for you. I mean, it would be much easier if I spoke Greek every day in my family. Then I would be able to pick up the New Testament and so forth. So obviously, the more you know of it and the more you use it, the better it will be. But it's not absolutely necessary. Even for those of us who did well in our linguistic studies, I don't always do Greek and Hebrew work when I prepare a sermon. And I don't say that like, see, I'm a bad boy too. I say that because I don't think that I have to every time do it. But it ought to be what you would expect normally. That's the natural expectation, the regular way to do that. How can you do work responsibly if you don't have a surpassing excellence and capability in the original languages? Well, the first thing you need to do is to compare translations. Since you're not going to prepare the translation yourself, then you need to take advantage of the fact that others have done it and pit them against one another, because that adversarial method is how you find out what is at stake, what needs to be resolved, what problems there might be. Now, Walt Kaiser talks about this in his Toward an Exegetical Theology. He talks about doing translation comparisons, and he's, of course, encouraging students who know Greek and Hebrew not just have a passing knowledge of it. Let me remind you what a passing knowledge includes. You know what the alphabet is? So you know how to put words together, you know how to look up words in Hebrew and Greek in a lexicon, and you need to know something about the way verbs are conjugated and nouns are parsed and so forth. You need to know what the categories are, nominative, genitive, dative, that sort of thing. You should be able to look things up then and be able to read a commentary or a technical grammar. Even though it will slow you down, you should be able to make sense out of it. So you have a working knowledge of Greek and Hebrew. So Kaiser is asking for more than that from his seminary students, but he says even they ought to do translation comparison. So now, back to my point. Translation comparisons. One I've had for many years, I'll just show you here. A comparison takes the same text from different translations and puts those in parallel columns so that you can read across the columns to get some idea of how the different translations have handled the particular text. The advantage of doing that is it gives you, one, you end up reading it more times, but you also get the subtle differences. One translator sees it this way, one translator sees it that. And when there is a difference, and this you can't forget, when you see the difference, you don't sit there and say, well, this one fits into the sermon that I want to preach better. Or this one is what I'd like it to be. Oh, I like it being put that way. I've heard people say that. It's irrelevant whether you like it. Now that you see that there's a difference, what do you have to do? You have to go to the original, you have to go to the lexicons, you have to go to the commentaries, and decide which is the proper way, or the most likely proper way to translate. So you do want to collect some translation comparisons. This one has four different ones, the King James, Revised Standard, Phillips, and New English. So we can get different ways of doing it. But then some comparisons are published differently. This book is the New Testament from 26 translations. My guess is there are others like it. This one may be out of print by now. But I want to show you how it's done here. Rather than having like four columns with the text of the different translations parallel to each other, it goes through the particular verses. And then every major phrase in a verse that has variants will be displayed separately in bold print, and then alternatives are given underneath it. Let me just read one at a whim here. Verse 16 of Acts 3, and his name through faith, in his name hath made this man strong, whom ye see and know. And then what is listed are a number of different translations for that. ASV, and by faith in his name hath his name. Over against this, what is this? Today's something New Testament, I forget. And it is by faith in the name of Jesus that this man, whom ye all see and know, has, by his name, been made strong. Another translation. In virtue of faith in his name has strengthened this man whom you behold and know. Williams. It is his name, that is, on condition of faith in his name, that has made strong again this man whom you see and recognize. Knox. Here is a man you all know by sight, who has put his faith in that name, and that name has brought him strength. Or the New English. In the name of Jesus, by awakening faith, has strengthened this man whom you see and know. Now, every one of those is slightly different. Okay, and so when you get ready to write up or make use of a text or to preach a text, you need to go in and look at the translations and look at the variants so you see what trouble spots there may be. Not that you might then say, this one is what I like best or fits better, but you'll know what kind of further research you have to do. Now, I took a really complicated illustration there. Here's one from Acts 18. Verse 2, and it just says, and came unto them. And you have Paul paid them a visit, went to see them, called on them, approached them, accosted them. All different ways of taking and came unto them. Do you suspect maybe some interpretations taking place in these translations? It's inevitable that a translation interprets. Right? So when people say, I don't like this particular version because it's a paraphrase, whereas this other one is, you know, word for word. Well, no, that's not right. Every translation, you take it out of Greek syntax and semantics, put it into English, every translation involves interpretation. However, there are some which try to stay closer to the syntax and the specific meaning of terms and don't give a more explanatory. That is, there's still degrees of interpretive work. And when you don't like a paraphrase, most of us don't like the Living Bible, because it just is too explanatory. And on top of that, we don't always agree with the explanations. But it's, you have to remember, all translation involves some degree of interpretation. So whether you are really good in Greek and Hebrew or you struggle along just using the tools, the first thing you need to get used to is translation comparisons. May you have a permanently guilty conscience if when you go to interpret the Bible, you don't compare various translations. I find that this is one of the easiest steps for people to skip because it takes time, it's a little aggravating, it slows you down, but it's irresponsible for you not to know the different ways in which people have handled it, especially if you can't go and be your own interpreter. I mean, if you have the linguistic competence of the translation committee and all the brains behind those fellows, and you said, well, I can on my own stand, that'd be fine, but none of us stands alone. You must have the humility to compare. Secondly, interlinear translations. Now, the interlinears, of course, which have for years been made fun of by those who are supposedly learning Greek and Hebrew, the interlinears will be crucial to those of you who are not bothering to take courses in Greek and Hebrew, because they're going to enable you to take the text word by word and see some connection with something you understand, the English underneath it, and then you can go back and look up those words in Hebrew or Greek in your lexicon and start building an exegetical case, even though you may not have personally had the ability in Greek and Hebrew to start with. You start in the Old Testament. I have an interlinear Hebrew. It's kind of tricky because you have to remember Hebrew is read from the right to the left. English from the left to the right. So when you do this interlinear work, it has English underneath it, but you have to move this way, and then of course to put it together, you have to think the other way, which is what you have in the column over here. There are different kinds of interlinears. This happens to be the one I'm using. But again, the point is you can see in English what word goes with what markings in Greek or Hebrew, and that will enable you then to be able to go and do further work. You'll have to do it slower than others, but you will not be cut off from doing it. Do not despair. You will be able to do original language work. And if anybody makes you feel guilty about using an interlinear, then you should be able to explain to them that not everybody is called of God to be a linguistic expert, and that those who don't use the interlinears probably are not as advanced in Greek and Hebrew as they think anyway, and you just as soon stick to this than your faulty memory and lack of training in the languages. So two types of translations: comparison translations, interlinear translations. The third kind of tool you need to have at your disposal: analytical lexicons and parsing guides. Analytical lexicons and parsing guides. An analytical lexicon is one that takes all the different forms of the words that are found in the Old Testament or in the New Testament and lists them out in alphabetical order and then gives you the conjugation or the parsing of the word. So even though you haven't learned how to do that in Greek and Hebrew, now that you've taken an interlinear and you can compare the marks, you know the alphabet, you can look it up in an analytical book and it will tell you what, you know, part of speech that is and how it's being used. So I have here a Hebrew analytical, and there are Greek as well. I want you to see a parsing guide at the same time. So I'm just going to take this at random again. I look up this word in Hebrew, and I follow the letters, you know, accordingly from my interlinear, and I say, Okay, if it's that particular form, that's a PL, preterist, third person, singular, masculine. Now, if you don't know English grammar, or if you don't know what the different possibilities are in Greek and Hebrew, that won't help you, right? But third person means what? He, she, it. But in this particular case, it's masculine, so you know it's going to be he. Not that it means personal necessarily, but so you have he, singular, rather than they, and you've got a PL, an intensive stem. Now, you don't know that's intensive until you study Hebrew grammar. That's what's coming up next. But the point is, you can look up that particular form, and if somebody's trying to make a conclusion from it, draw a conclusion from it that's questionable, or if you're trying to understand a difficult text because the translation comparison has shown you difficulty there, you can at least say, okay, now here are the possibilities, given that it has that grammatical function. If it's a PL, then there are various possibilities. And by the way, in lexicons, many times verbs, like a Hebrew verb, will have a different meaning in the PL than the nifal or what have you, and you can distinguish that, or it is distinguished for you, in the lexicon itself. I'm not pretending that this is an easy job for those who haven't studied the languages, but I'm going to keep insisting it's not impossible for you to do. An analytical is a great tool for you to have. This is a Hebrew one. Let me show you a Greek analytical. This too has all the Greek words in the New Testament, all the different forms that are found, whether they're verbs or nouns or adverbs or particles or whatever it may be. And then it lists for you, when you find the form, this particular one, a very long Greek word, happens to be a first person singular future indicative passive. Okay, so it's passive. It has something to do with action taking that has happened to the first person. So it's I have had something done, or it's future, I will have something done to me. Right, so you can put it together piece by piece if you want to do that kind of detailed study. Now, a parsing guide is, if you will, a different version of an analytical lexicon. In the first place, it doesn't deal with nouns and so forth. It only deals with, it only deals with the verbs. Yeah, that's what it's called, the parsing guide. But the organization is not according to the form of the Greek or the Hebrew. That is, so this is an alphabetical order according to Greek form, going down all the different ones. A parsing guide is organized according to the text of the New Testament. So you go through verse by verse by verse. Here I happen to be in the Gospel according to John, right at the beginning, chapter 1. And so I'm looking now at verse 30. And all of the verbs in verse 30 of John chapter 1 are listed out here. And then I am given what their particular form is and the verb from which they come. You can see that there's a real advantage to this, because with the analytical, you go running back and forth from this verse, look up this form, then, you know, the next word in the verse, look up this form. Whereas, at least on the verbs, not the nouns, all of them for that verse are already laid out for you. It's like somebody's gone in and done all the, you know, background work for you. So analytical lexicons and parsing guides are crucial for you to know what the Greek or Hebrew word is and what its particular form and syntax are. And you'll have to know those things, because the next portion of our lecture, section 5, we're not there yet by any means, but when we get there, is going to be a discussion. I'm only going to focus on Greek in this class, but it'd be a discussion of the different kinds of functions of, say, genitives and datives and aorist and future tenses and things like that. So if you're going to be able to interpret that and get back to this is used in this way, you have to begin with the interlinear that shows you the form, go to an analytical or a parsing guide to see what the grammatical category is, what it falls into. Is it future? Is it present tense? Whatever. Is it nominative? Is it dative in terms of nouns? And then you can take the next step of asking, okay, well then how would that be translated, or in what way would it be taken? And for that, you need grammars of Greek and Hebrew. Grammars of Greek and Hebrew. In the same way that when you were in elementary and junior high school, maybe in high school as well, you learned about English grammar from books that tell you how words are used and put together in sentences, there are grammars that teach us about Hebrew verbs and nouns and prepositions and the way in which they can be organized and how they're to be taken. Obviously, if you're going to learn the language, you're going to go through a grammar. But if you have not taken a course in Greek or Hebrew, you can still learn from the grammar itself. Because once you find the form that the analytical lexicon has given you, then you can go and do some study about what that form is all about. Maybe you're not going to memorize all the different things about it, but I turned to this arbitrarily in my beginner's handbook to biblical Hebrew. We read of cal infinitives and participles. You have to know what an infinitive and a participle is, but we read the infinitives are nouns. They are verbal substantives. So that you know that if you found something in your analytical that says this is an infinitive, you realize that that functions as a verbal substantive. It functions like a noun. Of course, you would have known that from English too, maybe not the greatest example. So you need grammars. Now, some grammars go beyond basic teaching how to, you know, break down the verbs and the nouns and translate and give you a little bit more in terms of the force or function, the aspects and so forth of the various grammatical forms. So I have here the Hebrew Student's Manual that tells us about verbal nouns from the regular verb and participles, and here's irregular verbs and cardinal numbers and how they're to be understood in Hebrew, and here are the adverbs and the particles in general, that sort of thing. So having a grammar at your disposal may help you. It will also help you, not just because you've gone immediately to the text from your analytical to what the grammar says about it, but if you read in a commentary, somebody says, well, because it's in this form, we draw the following conclusion, you may want to check that against what a grammar will tell you. Maybe the grammar tells you, well, there are other possibilities. Maybe it doesn't say what this guy said at all. But the door is open for you to do some research, and you need some grammars. Now, I have, especially in Greek, we have some really great grammars, and one that I'd like all of you to get. I told you I wouldn't recommend in every case, but I'll make an exception here. Everybody should have Dana and Manti, a manual grammar of the Greek New Testament. This is a very convenient tool so that you can go in. I just happen to open here to the verb, and it explains to you about Greek verbs, voice, person, and number. The active voice, so it's explained to you how you have simple active, causative active, you have the middle voice, indirect middle, permissive middle, reciprocal middle, and the passive voice. It gives you all the virtually all the variations, then irregularities in voice and so forth. This is very good because it's laid out so clearly, and it gives, you know, the subdivisions. Okay, so you have this general topic, and then it can be used this way, used this way, used this way. It's very good for you to have. And then comparisons of Greek grammars is always helpful because not all the grammarians agree. In a few minutes, well, probably won't be tonight, but when I get to the grammatical analysis lecture, I'm going to be talking about the way grammarians many times oversimplify and make mistakes about the language. In particular, I'll talk to you about the aorist tense in Greek and how it is overinterpreted by many people. So it's good to compare grammarians. Don't ever let language guys lord it over you. You see this in guys who first learn Greek and Hebrew, or you know, first year students in seminary, or pastors that are amateurs pretending like they're experts. They'll say, well, as Thayer's lexicon says, you say, okay, so Thayer says that, that may be a place to begin the discussion, but that doesn't settle anything. Now, somebody says, you know, for instance, this happens to be one of the most authoritative, and I find very helpful, of Blas de Bruyne, Greek grammar. Somebody says, well, as Blas de Bruyne say about the accusative and the double accusative, so forth. Yeah, but, you know, you may look up in Robertson or in somebody else. Here I have Moulton's grammar of the New Testament Greek. And sometimes they differ with each other. Sometimes one is over general. Sometimes nuances aren't taken into effect. This is not exciting reading, at least for most people. I have known a few people who are kind of strange and get real excited about Greek grammar or Hebrew grammar. Most of you won't. But then things that are worthwhile in life are not always exciting. If you're going to be faithful to the Lord Jesus, you must be able to go to the original language and ask how it should be translated, how it functions, and if you aren't yourself a speaker of Greek and Hebrew and very competent, then you're going to need interlinears, analytical lexicons and parsing guides, and then grammars, so that you can find out what the various functions are. I'm going to give you a grammatical summary of Greek in our next unit here when I go over grammatical analysis, and I'll expect you to then do further work in Hebrew. I just want to illustrate what a grammar is like and certain highlights, if you will, of Greek grammar. But you can do that for yourself without a lecturer. If you have a Dina and Manti or a Blas de Bruyne or, you know, one of these Hebrew guides and so forth. The fifth kind of tool for exegesis that you need to have in your libraries will be lexicons, or if you will, dictionaries that show you how to translate Hebrew words and Greek words. The Hebrew ones are usually killers. It's one of the biggest books in my library. Hebrew and English Lexicon of the Old Testament, Brown Driver Briggs, a standard reference tool. Gassanius has one. There are others. But now that you know from the interlinear, as well as your analytical work, what the word is, it isn't enough just to have its grammatical function or its syntactical relations. You have to know what the word means, right, as an individual word. And so you go to the lexicon to look it up. Now, these can be intimidating because there's so much technical apparatus in them. But the breakdown of a lexicon is essentially easy. You have to know what stuff to jump over and so forth. I just want to take a fairly easy illustration. Okay, here we have a verb in Hebrew. Now, I've looked it up because I know the alphabet, and it's nagad. It's a verb to mean the very first thing that you read. Why am I looking at it? I already know how to use a lexicon. It tells you, verb, be conspicuous. And then in parentheses, it goes through a lot of comparisons and so forth. And then starts a listing of how it's used in the hifal stem. And then how it's used, you know, in various ways. And then a number of texts will be given for each one. If it's in the infinitive absolute and all that. So if you want to see how it's used or find it, there's a lot of detail here you might not want. But after you wade through all the opening comparative material and the different forms and where they might be found in the Old Testament, eventually you'll find, let your eye fan down here. Did I change? That's not the one I want. Here we go. Hard to read it upside down. Number one. What's it say? Adam, tell, announce. Okay. And then it gives places where it's thought by this author or researcher that that's how the word is being used. Then number two.
Declare.
To declare or make known. And then places where it's used like that. And then sometimes you'll have A, B, and C underneath. That is variants. Near synonyms or differences. This particular one has 3, 4, and 5, I can see, and then a hafal section as well. So that gives you some idea of how a Hebrew dictionary, a Hebrew lexicon, works. This is a very technical one. Like I say, it seems intimidating, but as long as you're willing to go slow, you know that it's going to give you background material, comparative work, and give you a general definition, and then it's going to specify, used in this way, one, two, three. It's always fascinating when you find a verb or a noun being used in ways which don't seem to be related to each other at all, quite different. That happens sometimes. You need to look them up in the lexicon. It is not good enough to go to your Strong's Concordance, find the tag number for the verb or the noun, look it up in the back and say, okay, that's what it means. As well as some kind of, then a computer could do it for you. You know, tag number this, well, you know, Strong's and others give us brief definitions. This may go too far the other direction and intimidate you because there's so much detail, but you do need to realize you have to consider various possible meanings for the word. Now, when I get the meaning of the verb, let's say it is to make known. And now, I have to take into account, additionally, its grammatical form. If it's future passive, to make known means for me to have been made known, or to be made known to me, perhaps, in the future. So you get its function, its syntactical function, and its particular meaning from, well, the function from the grammar, the meaning of the word from the lexicon. Now that's a heavy Hebrew one. Let me look at a New Testament one. Did I bring it down here? I'm sure I did. Obviously, this is going to work about the same. The standard that's used in our circles is Artin Gingrich, which is really updating a Bauer's lexicon of the New Testament, a Greek-English lexicon of the New Testament, other early Christian literature. The background work that's done for words in this lexicon is usually going to come from early Christian literature, the church fathers, the papyri and things like that, although there are references to classical Greek and other kinds of literature occasionally as well. And this would work the same way that I showed you with the Hebrew. You look up in your interlinear what the form is. You go to the parsing guide or the analytical to see what the stem is and how that's being used. And then you look up that stem, that original word from which, you know, it was developed, parsed out or conjugated out. And you're going to find background material and then various translations, one, two in that case. Some go on for pages in here. See if I can find a nice long one. See? Okay, lambano, a very common Greek verb. It goes on for one, two, three, virtually four columns. And then you'll have subdivisions under each particular kind of translation. And then you have illustrations or how, you know, places where it's thought to be used in that way, so forth. And so if you're willing to go line by line and read the abbreviations and so forth, you'll, let's say you're doing work on Romans chapter 4 on a particular verb there, and you look it up here, you'll see what some authority has said about that in Romans 4, or how it was categorized as its use and meaning in Romans 4. Does that mean just because this is basically a standard that they're always right? I don't always agree with Artin Gingrich. I know better than to think I can, you know, lord it over them and always tell them they're wrong, but every once in a while I have to say I'm not so sure that it has been categorized right. So these aren't rule books, these are history books, they're summaries. Keep that in mind. Another kind is the vocabulary of the Greek New Testament, Moulton and Milligan, where this uses the New Testament and early Greek literature for its stock of illustrations, showing you how to translate Greek terms. This is broader than that. It goes into the secular papyri of the period, and is often fascinating for showing us how the word is used outside of New Testament and Christian context. Okay? But you understand how a lexicon works. I think I've said enough about that. Before I go on to the next kind of reference tool, number six, I want to show you something which I just learned about a few weeks ago, and from one of my students that I'm teaching hermeneutics on a private basis. He brought to one of our tutoring sessions these. He said, have you ever seen these? And I was just overwhelmed. Recently, a friend of mine who teaches New Testament in a theological seminary, I took them to him and said, have you seen this? It's really quite amazing. He hadn't either. And though we do recognize a few of the names on the editorial board as being evangelicals, something this massive and with so many editors, when we don't know any more about it, I want to give you a word of caution. I don't know what we're getting into, but it certainly looks like somebody's done a lot of work that will prove very helpful. I basically said, you need to go to an interlinear, do your analytical lexicon work, find the grammatical form and its function, look up the word in the lexicon and so forth. Look at this. In terms of being an interlinear that does all of that for you, and as a bonus, does the textual critical work as well. And we're not going to get into textual criticism in our hermeneutics class. We cover that in biblical criticism. But in terms of comparing ancient manuscripts for readings and strength of this reading over against that, so it may be that this is the way people should go. Then a translation is offered over here. So you have the interlinear with the, in this case, the Greek form. Then you have the verb from which it comes. It tells you, it has an indexing system, a numbering system. So it's verb number 453.20 in the third plural indicative, aorist passive indicative. And on top of that, gives you translation comparisons in the final column over here. I have to admit, I was pretty overwhelmed, especially overwhelmed that I had never seen it, because I try to keep up on most of this stuff. But everything that we've covered so far, it doesn't give you a lot of grammatical guidance, but other than the grammars, it does all that background for you, including textual criticism. And this is called the Complete Biblical Library. The Complete Biblical Library. And I was told that. I think 16 volumes altogether. Now what I have just shown you, maybe I should mention for the sake of those on tape, it's published by World Library Press in Springfield, Missouri. World Library Press in Springfield, Missouri. And the dates seem to be real recent, 1991, 1992, and so forth. It tells you how to use it at the beginning and so forth. I really wish I had had enough time to do the research to just tell you straight out, go buy this, it's worth it. It looks like it's going to be a great help to my students for doing all that background work for you, having it all in one place. Now, this goes through, like, I have Acts in my hands. And I won't have the right numbers, but there is a Greek-English, and I take it that they'll have a Hebrew-English dictionary as well. And this gives us alpha through gamma, 1 through 1131. I'm not sure if I have any of those numbers here that I can use as an illustration quickly. Yeah, here's 831. Okay, so if I've looked here in Acts, 1224, and I have the verb 831.10, then I go to their dictionary and I look up 831. So you don't even have to do all of the alphabetizing yourself and look it up. You just go to the number 831. And not only does it give you the translation of the word, it gives you synonyms, Hebrew equivalents, And then all the different forms that it appears in the New Testament are listed. And then you have it translated for you. Classical and Greek and Septuagintal discussion, New Testament usage, and then some bibliographical work. So if you had the interlinear here coded to this, we're saving a lot of time. I just hope these guys don't turn out to be some cultic group or something. And again, I wish I could tell you for sure, but we do see some evangelical names there, a few, but it's just a massive work. So I've brought that to your attention. It would be a shame for you not to use this if you've got to do all the work with these other things. I'm sure they're very expensive as well. Okay, let's move on. Number six, a further tool for exegesis, cross-reference systems that you find either published in a Bible, like the ASV, which I think is the best cross-reference system, or the NIV, which is fairly nice. The NIV Study Bible has a cross-reference system. You've probably all heard of the Thompson Chain Link Bible, which is a very rich cross-reference type of system. Once you've gone and looked at the translation comparison, so you know what the difficulties in a text may be, the various possibilities, you've checked it in the interlinear, gotten its grammatical form from the analytical, checked the meaning of the grammar in the textbooks on grammar, gone to the lexicon to get the semantic meaning of the term, so you've done that kind of detailed background work, it'd be good to know how that term or that concept, sometimes, but usually that term, is used elsewhere. So I brought my ASV with me tonight just to give you an idea how this works. So in the book of Romans, I read, one man esteems one day above another, another esteems every day alike, let each man be fully assured in his own mind. And fully assured has a small little footnote tag, a G. And I've got to go to the middle column, and because the alphabet runs out every 26, sometimes you get in the wrong segment. But if you find the G that's intended here, this tells me that I can look at chapter 4, verse 21 in Romans, and that should have some kind of insightful comparison. Let every man be fully assured. Verse 21 of chapter 4 says, of Abraham, and being fully assured that what he had promised, that is God, he was able to perform. And then there are others. I'm not going to go through them all. But a cross-reference enables you to see how that term is used by the same author or other authors in the Bible. And I don't know if I can give you any practical help at all. I find the cross-reference system perhaps the most helpful of all the tools that help you prepare a message or to understand the text, because you can get, this is how it's used here, here's other nuances or ideas that are added to it. You can see how the Bible says similar things in other places, so you should check cross-references. It doesn't have to be the ASV, other ones may help you as well. In the same category, I would put harmonies, particularly of the gospel, although there could be other kinds of harmonies as well. The one I brought tonight to show you is by A.T. Robertson, a fairly standard one. This is a kind of cross-reference because, like in the synoptic gospels, or John as well, but mainly in the, you know what synoptic means, to look together, right? So they look very much alike. You'll read a passage in Mark and Matthew, maybe John, but usually it's Matthew, Mark, Luke. And you wonder, why are some things covered in one gospel and not in another, or how are they put slightly differently in another gospel? And a harmony helps you to compare. So here we have in this particular page I turn to, Mark, Matthew, and John lined up in terms of the order of the events that Robertson, you know, believed took place in the New Testament in the life of Jesus and the discourses of it. And I don't know if I got a great example, but so in Matthew 26, verse 52, then saith Jesus unto him, put up again thy sword into its place, for all they that take the sword shall perish with the sword. You have in Luke 22:51 what is considered by this author to be a parallel. But Jesus answered and said, suffer ye thus far, and he touched his ear and healed him. So that's good for a comparison of the particular emphasis of the writer that you're working with, or more material on the same event that another writer brought in. So cross-references and harmonies are the sixth type of lexical or exegetical tool that you should be consulting when you go to interpret a text. Seventhly, you should look into resources that deal with idioms, synonyms, or phrases. Idioms, synonyms, or phrases. There are different kinds of tools, and again, I'm only illustrating, but I brought tonight, for instance, in the Old Testament, I have a book, Synonyms of the Old Testament. You've already found what the word is. You've looked it up in your lexicon. You've done some comparison of how it's used elsewhere by the same author or other biblical authors. It may be good for you, however, to check synonyms of the word and various words that are used in the same way. So in this case, Girdleston's Synonyms of the Old Testament, I've turned to his discussion of the word congregation. And he'll go through the various places where that word is used and the various Hebrew words that are used to translate it, the difference between temple and tabernacle, for instance, and then congregation, different words that are used for it. And he goes into New Testament words, the ecclesia. And though they aren't always right, they aren't a rule book, they give insight as to the nuances and differences so that you have the specific use of a word that's before you. I have one, Synonyms of the New Testament by Trench, which is a fairly well-known reference work. So he'll take a number of Greek words here that have a similar meaning, and then go through and show how they differ from each other, or how they are similar in their use. C.F.D. Moule, an idiom book of New Testament Greek. Every language has idiomatic expressions and idiomatic functions. And this particular book deals with improper prepositions, that is, prepositions that are not used in the normal way, and how they are to be taken, how the different voices or aspects of the Greek verbs, how the tenses can be used, not in a strict computer-generated one-for-one way that you understand it this way, but you need to know the nuances and the various ways it could be done. So the idioms can be studied. And then there are books like this one that's a phrase book of the Bible. It actually goes in, I believe this is both, yes, Old and New Testament, and you'll have phrases that are found. The one I just turned to arbitrarily, Matthew 21:32, the publicans and the harlots. This phrase, first appearing in Matthew 21:32, consists of two nouns, each modified by their different articles and joined by the conjunction chi. The first noun is best rendered tax collectors. In ancient Rome, the government often sold the privilege of collecting taxes, etc., etc. So you see this phrase a number of times, the publicans and the harlots, and this gives you some idea of how that is used and how it's functioned in that semantic period.
This leads then to the eighth tool for exegesis that you should consult, and that's concordances. Concordances, whether in Hebrew, Greek, or English, they're all valuable for use. The value of a concordance is similar to that of a cross-reference system, and then it enables you to see in the broadest perspective how the word in Hebrew or Greek is used, how many times it's used, and all the different ways that it's used. Now here in my Hebrew concordance, to take an example, takes words in alphabetical order as they appear in the Old Testament, and let's say you find this particular noun in the Old Testament, it goes through in order of the canon every appearance of the word and gives a little English translation where the Hebrew appears. In many cases they'll be broken down according to the particular parsing of the verb in Hebrew or Greek. But this helps so you can see how the word is used elsewhere for comparison purposes. They have Greek concordances as well. Well, here we have one which is used only once in the New Testament, and one quite a few times. And it's good to be able to go in and see, oh, well, it has this kind of use here, that kind of use there. Am I, you know, taking it properly in my initial reading and the text that's before me? Then there are English concordances, and I really don't have to say much about that. No one's going to have gotten this far in their studies and not know how to use a concordance, right? But exhaustive concordances are exhausting. Good to take the English translation sometimes and see all the different texts where that particular English word is used for the translation. The difficulty is with the multiplication of popular translations in our day, this Strong's that I happen to have brought, which is based on the King James, isn't going to help you if you're looking up a verse that was translated in the NIV. And so the NIV has its own concordance. I take it they have an exhaustive one. I haven't purchased it. They have various concordances. And so these are tied to specific translations. In the case of Strong's, every word that is entered here is given a tag number where you can go to the back and see what the particular word is and the various ways in which it's translated. One nice thing about this, even if you don't look up all of them, is that if you see two or three numbers repeating in a long column here, it'd be good to know which of those specific Hebrew or Greek words is being used in your text, because if the word that has a particular connotation, I'm using that in the literary sense, because that's number 3412, let's say, has that connotation, but that's not the word translated by the same English word in the text in front of you, then you don't want to go before your people and say, and this has this sense. You say, well, if it had been a different Greek or Hebrew word, it might, but it doesn't in this particular case. So it's valuable to have that, but I wouldn't ever depend upon Strong's tagging system in the place of going to the lexicons yourself. And of course, since this is dealing with an English translation, that is the user receiving end of things, it's really easier to go to the Greek or Hebrew and work with the actual word in the original and how it appears elsewhere in the Old or New Testaments. Number nine, our tools for exegesis. I hope you can see I'm kind of building up. We started with lexicons, then we looked at comparison of words, cross-references, then we noted idioms and synonyms and phrase books, how those words are, you know, used in a stylized way. Then concordances gave us the total picture of how the word is used throughout. Ninth, we come to theological word books, sometimes called theological dictionaries of the Old Testament or the New Testament. I have as an example a theological word book of the Old Testament edited by Harris, Archer, and Walke. And this expands on what you've learned about the word, because some scholar will go in, like here, this is a good example, ruach in Hebrew, which means wind, breath, mind, or spirit. And then it gives you something of the history of the word and the various ways in which it's used, some of the theological implications or applications, some of the troubled text, and then bibliography if you want to do more work on Ruach in Hebrew. And sometimes it just shows you what the derivative is, what the basic meaning of the word is in the different texts in which it's used. But this is like an expanded lexicon to incorporate comparative work, etymological work, applicatory work, troubled text, and various ways of translating. The best known word book, the Bible, of course, is Kittle's Theological Dictionary of the New Testament. That's the English translation. I just have the one volume edition here. I forget how many volumes there are. It's a really weighty work. One of the reasons why I haven't bothered to invest in all of them, it's good to have a little bit of this, but frankly, it's overdone. James Barr's book, The Semantics of Biblical Language, really exploded the theory of language and language use that lied behind the research of Kittle and his other researchers and editors. And the problem with them is they often treat words, as I indicated to you in a previous lecture, as though they were whole sentences or ideas, so that every time a word appears, it's always an accumulation of all the previous sentences and uses. Nevertheless, for all of that, you can get a lot of detail background work, how the word is used in classical context, how it's used in the Old Testament, where it's used in the New, the different kinds of uses in the New. And in the case of what we might call quasi-technical theological words, redemption, covenant, things like that, kingdom, and obviously a word like this, not because words function in that way all the time, but some words do take on a technical or theoretical nature. I told you about theoretical definitions in science, oscillator, and so forth. Well, at some point in the development of God's revelation, covenant, kingdom, and other words have taken on a kind of technical meaning. So when they do all the background and so forth, they can be very beneficial to you. As long as you don't fall into the fallacies of language use, a theological word book like Kittle's can be beneficial. I have this one, the one volume edition. There's a three volume edition done by people that are a bit more, oh, that's another thing I have to tell you as we're moving away from the more technical stuff. You have to start watching who's writing up these discussions. In the case of the Kittle word book, there's a lot of higher critical garbage and theological nonsense that's incorporated as presuppositions in the writers. So I'm glad I have this down on tape, and I want to emphasize for you here, you mustn't ever go to this as though this is a rule for you. So, well, this settles it. If they tell you that this word has got to be taken in that way, well, you've got to be discerning. Some stuff you're going to weed out. Other stuff you're going to find good. Anyway, a fairly conservative Dictionary of New Testament Theology, the New International Dictionary of New Testament Theology, was edited by Colin Brown. I say relatively more conservative, not conservative enough, but this may be more beneficial for those who don't want to have to worry about all the kinds of presuppositions of the Kittle researchers. And this works in a similar way. You look up the term. Sadly, this is organized according to the English translation. So you'll take the word here, empty, and then it looks at the various Greek words that are used and translated as empty or to be emptied and so forth. I wish it were organized just according to the Greek. I find it easier to find things that way. So now what I have to do is I have to go into volume 3, where they have the index of the Greek words and all the volumes in which this particular Greek verb is discussed. And it may be, you know, three or four different articles through the three things, so you have to be pulling things down. So I don't like the organization, but the material can often be very helpful. Theological word books. Number 10, we come to a different kind of exegetical tool, what I'm going to call Septuagintal tools. That is, tools for helping you use the Septuagint. The Septuagint is the Greek translation of the Old Testament scriptures. the Greek translation of the Old Testament scriptures, done while the Jews were in exile in Egypt, in Alexandria, I believe, and it became the standard for the Jews who had become Greek-speaking to understand their Old Testament according to that, because it was more cosmopolitan, and those who had been in exile and around the world were more familiar with it than, say, Masoretic Hebrew. The advantage of having some knowledge of the Septuagint is that you can use it as a bridge between the Old and New Testament. If you're doing research on a concept or a word, you can go to, say, the New Testament. You find the word for redemption, and then you look up that word, that Greek word, in the Septuagint, and then when you find out where it appears in the Septuagintal Old Testament, you can find the Hebrew equivalents that were there originally, and then study those Hebrew words. Now, you mustn't fall into the trap of thinking you can automatically draw conclusions by means of this bridge, but it does open the door to possibilities and gives you a broader perspective on the use of the word. What I've brought for you tonight is a Greek and English Septuagint. This is not as nice as an interlinear, but pretty much functions like that. You can use it quickly. You have the Greek text here, and then the English translation at the side, so you can try to find what the words are. Now, there are some differences, I can't go into them all tonight, between the Septuagint text of the Old Testament and the Hebrew. And that will surprise you. You need to kind of hang loose to this and be flexible so you know how to get around and not be thrown when you don't find exactly what you thought, going one way or another. And anyway, so you can now find the Greek equivalent of the Hebrew. There's also different textual traditions for the Septuagint, even as for the New Testament, and as there is in the Hebrew as well. So sometimes you have to, you know, we're looking at family alpha here, or gamma, what have you. But nevertheless, this will enable you to see the Old Testament in Greek. So you can go from an Old Testament word to the Greek that was used in the Septuagint, then look in the New Testament for that Greek word, or you can work backwards. Then they also have, at least I have had for a number of years, a concordance of the Septuagint. This helps because you can take the Greek word that you're studying and find all the different places. Now, it's not written out pretty nicely, but you have all the references anyway for where that Greek word is found in the Septuagint. You can go in and do a study how it's done. Is this necessary, Dr. Bonson? Well, there are degrees of necessity. Is this the sort of thing that you ought to be looking at when you do serious exegesis? Absolutely. You should work back and forth between the Old and New Testaments, and it's the Septuagint that enables us to do that. Number 11, Bible dictionaries and encyclopedias. Bible dictionaries and encyclopedias. These are tools that you're familiar with already in English usage. They aren't the technical, theological word book type tools, but rather what any English reader can pick up in a Bible bookstore. I have, for instance, here Unger's Bible Dictionary. If you're going to do exegesis, not only are you going to go back and do all the grammatical and semantical work, but you should see what else you can learn about that word or concept. I just happened to turn here to first fruit. Okay, so that's a particular kind of offering, right? But it's also an expression used in the New Testament. Christ is the first fruits of them that sleep. So you want to go in and get some background on how that word, how that phrase, how that concept appears in the Bible. Now, writers of dictionaries, just like people who gloss words in lexicons, are interpreting. When you read something in a dictionary, you're not reading a rule. It must be taken in this way. You're reading somebody making a claim about the historical function and so forth. And theological presuppositions come through. Unger is affected by his dispensationalism sometimes in what you read. Now, not so terribly that I didn't think it was worth buying. In fact, I happen to think this is a pretty good Bible dictionary. But I'm just, again, putting you, you always have to read critically, with a critical mindset. This is a one-volume dictionary. You can get encyclopedias that are multi-volume. This particular one, the Zondervan Victorial Encyclopedia of the Bible, does the same sort of thing, but goes into even further detail. It has more things that it talks about, and talks about them in greater detail, especially theological topics, historical accounts, and that sort of thing. And again, since you've already mastered the use of these things, if you're any kind of advanced student of the Bible, I trust you understand what I'm getting at. The value of the dictionaries and encyclopedias of the Bible. Number 12, you should consult atlases and chronologies so that you know something of the time and place of the text or the event described in the text. Atlases and chronologies. Two examples. This, I think, is probably still the standard. You'll get atlases and Bible dictionaries and at the back of your Bible, too. But if you want to get something thorough, the Oxford Bible Atlas goes through the various periods, Old Testament and New, as well as cultural background. So as it goes through here in this page, we're to Israel and Canaan rather than the Exodus. So there you have a map of the course of the Exodus. Now in Canaan, you get a map of that. Palestine in Old Testament times, a total map. This is the sort of thing that people want to just kind of skip. You say, well, who cares, you know? It happens. Well, sometimes it helps to see how far away, say, Emmaus is from Jerusalem. Okay, or where is the Mount of Olives over against Jerusalem? Where is the Dead Sea in comparison to, and what's the Jordan River, where's the Red Sea? It helps you to understand, to visualize where events are taking place, sometimes the significance of where they are. If you look in your atlas and find out, oh, Jesus is up in the area near the Samaritans, maybe that has something to do with the kind of theology that he's emphasizing to these northern tribes that have broken away from the central sanctuary in Jerusalem and so forth. So a Bible atlas can affect your interpretation and your understanding of a text. Place and time. I brought a book on chronological aspects of the life of Christ. If you don't already know this, you probably realize that there are certain things about the order of events in the Gospels that are unclear as we read different accounts. One of the things that's always been fascinating is how do you date the various things that happened in the Passion Week? And on what day was Christ crucified? Was it Friday or was it Thursday? You know, there are people who make arguments one way or another. So if you're going to do a study of time and place of the narrative or the event being narrated, it's good to have tools like this so that you can do some background and at least know what the questions are that have to be answered. Archaeological studies should be consulted for their bearing on your text also. As an example of a kind of book that deals with archaeology and its bearing on biblical interpretation, I've brought in Light from the Ancient Past, a fairly well-known reference work. It's subtitled The Archaeological Background of the Hebrew Christian Religion. And this is really fascinating. I often wish I had time just to peruse it without having to go and look for particular things. It goes through the history of the Old Testament, shows you wall reliefs and pottery and so forth, and then also from the various things that have been dug up out of the earth, how terms are used, what legal concepts, what political constitutions were, you know, working during the time that your text was uttered or written down. And sometimes we take texts that are very difficult, words we're not familiar with or a notion that seems strange, and archaeologists bring us light from outside, from the other cultures or from the particular culture of Israel itself, that show us how to interpret that text. So you need to know something about archaeology and study its bearing on your text. The 14th kind of tool of exegesis that you should be consulting when you want to do technical work on a text would be historical introductions.
There are books that are written about the history of the period, whatever period in the Bible you're looking at, or maybe the whole history of the Old Testament or the New Testament, and you need to be able to put things in the context of the flow of history if you're going to do historical grammatical exegesis. So I have as an example here A History of Israel from Conquest to Exile by Davis and Whitcomb. So that you should read a book like this. Of course, it'd be good if you read it and then bring it to bear on different texts as you come along rather than having to read it the first time when you go to a particular text. Nevertheless, a book like this and others you should be familiar with so that you can see how this event or how this particular discourse fits into its own historical setting. F.F. Bruce, New Testament History, gives you the flow of events in the New Testament both inside and outside the Bible. That helps a lot, you know, when people read about the birth of Jesus being in the reign of Tiberius. Well, who was Tiberius? You know, what do we know about him from Roman history? What's his significance? What was his relationship to the Jews? Things of that nature. So historical context has to be considered. 15th, cultural context should be considered as well. And there are books that talk about the way people lived, what they ate, how they dressed, how they related to each other politically, how their families related to one another, their economic systems, and on and on. There are many different books. As an example, I brought in the Old Testament, Ancient Israel by Roland DeVoe, which is two volumes. A Roman Catholic, somewhat liberal scholar, but nevertheless, just to give you an idea, he has a chapter on law and justice in the Old Testament, which was fascinating to me as I did, for instance, my master's thesis on the use of the law of God in political settings in the Bible. So this gives some background and gives his interpretation of certain texts and the importance of the law of God. You have the person of the king, how slaves were treated, how children were treated, marriage ordinances, the armies of Israel, warfare, and this is only one of two volumes. So you should know something about the general teaching of the Bible and what we know from archaeology and historical background for how people lived, their cultural institutions. A New Testament illustration, Merrill Tenney's New Testament Times. The title tells you everything, right? Gives you insight into the Jewish heritage, the pagan heritage, the political scene and the tensions there, and then goes through the life of Christ and the early church and shows the background culturally. You know, when Paul went to various places in the ancient world to minister, what did it look like? What were the people like there? What did he confront? What kind of problems would he have had? So forth. So there you get the cultural background in addition to the historical background. 16, you should consult introductions to the biblical books. A standard reference work for those who are doing exegetical interpretation of Old and New Testament text are found in, for instance, Donald Guthrie's New Testament Introduction. There are Old Testament introductions, Gleason Archer and E.J. Young and others that you can look up in bibliographically. The nice thing about these introductions is that they go book by book and give you the historical setting as understood by the author. Sometimes there's questions about that. Who is the book written to? Who is the book about? What's its major theme and outline? During what time period was it written? Or what time period is it written about? Those sorts of introductory questions are taken up in a Bible introduction. Now, there are also books that are less than everything in the Old Testament or less than everything in the New. But I've just brought you one that happens to cover all the New Testament books as an introductory guide. But you do need to have some idea of who was being written to. In the book of Hebrews, were we writing to Gentiles or to Jews? There's an argument either way. I happen to feel strongly about my own conclusion on that, but it affects
how you take what the author is writing and why he's writing in this way. Why the detail on this? Why does he bring these things together? And when was it written? Just to provoke you a bit or to whet your appetites, why is it when we examine the dates of the New Testament books, is there any significance to the fact that all of the New Testament books that mention tongues are the earliest books of the New Testament, and that by the end of the New Testament period, we have no further references to or debates in the church or difficulties with tongues? Now, you can see what I'm suggesting. That's only a suggestion. It proves nothing. But knowing something about the chronology of New Testament writings or Old Testament writings might affect your feelings about and your interpretation of the text that's in front of you. Seventeen, commentaries. Now that, again, you probably didn't need a course in hermeneutics to figure out that commentaries help you to interpret the Bible. But do remember that commentaries are, again, somebody else doing all the other work that I've told you you need to do and coming up with his conclusions. That is, just because he's done the background work doesn't mean he did it right. You've got to compare the commentaries. They don't always agree with each other. So compare your commentaries, even as you compare your translations. Now, not all commentaries are going to use the original languages. Many times you'll get transliterations of the original or no attempt to reflect the original in the commentary itself. But I've brought you a couple of examples that do use the original, because as you do this work, even if Greek and Hebrew are not things that you've mastered, you're going to get back to the bottom, as it were, and work out the details, the different interpretations. You do have to be able to get into the original expressions. Now, in this particular case, I have the Word Biblical Commentary on Micah through Malachi. And as you can see here, there's a discussion of different Hebrew forms in the particular passage that the guy's going to go on and give a commentary on. In this, you also get his form critical analysis of it, which I don't always think is very beneficial. One usually has liberal assumptions to it. But there are commentaries, I just want to point out to you, that will take you back to the original and help you work on difficult texts there. I brought also Cranfield's Cambridge Greek commentary on the Gospel of Mark. Really excellent commentary, very helpful. That as it goes through, you can see it gives you the Greek rather than the English, and then comments on the Greek text, or word by word, phrase by phrase. We're hurrying to get done tonight. Obviously, you need to load up your library with commentaries. Do a lot of comparison work. How have different people interpreted? How have they organized the material, say in Mark or in Romans or what have you? And as I've indicated as well, make sure you compare them to one another. Then in addition to that, 18th, you should look at specialized studies. If commentaries cover the entire range of a book of the Bible or a section of the literature, specialized studies focus on one or another aspect of the text and try to go into greater detail and resolve special problems with respect to it. I brought two specialized, no I didn't, I brought one specialized study.
Two, here we are.
Maybe three. Who knows what we have? It's Christmas time around here. E.J. Young's Study in Genesis 1. This is not a commentary on Genesis 1. He doesn't start at Genesis 1:1 and work through the entire chapter, but he takes up particular aspects of it. The relation of verse 1 of Genesis 1 to verses 2 and 3. 15 pages or 14 pages of technical discussion of how those verses relate to one another. So this is a specialized, this would be like taking a commentary and then blowing up even more the particular discussion of those verses or that aspect of things. I just took this at random. Sugg's Wisdom, Christology, and Law in Matthew's Gospel. If you were doing an interpretation of Matthew,
a book like this might be beneficial as you come to Matthew's dealing with the concept of law or concept of wisdom and how they relate to each other. Gale's book, The Use of Analogy in the Letters of Paul. Here he's taken a subdivision of the literature and focused on one aspect of it. You can't get this in all the other books because it's too particular, it's too picky. But it does help you when it comes down to it. You want to know, how does Paul use comparisons, and what comparisons are in what books, and why not elsewhere, and so forth. 19th, studies of authors of the Bible. The example that I brought into class tonight is Herman Ritterbos, Paul, An Outline of His Theology, which is a real sweet and sour sauce kind of thing for me, because many parts of this are brilliant and other parts are very questionable and hard to accept. But I wanted you to see there is literature that will study just Pauline literature. There will be things that are written on Johannine literature, say Mosaic literature, something like that. So sometimes the scholarship focuses on a topic in a particular place, like Genesis 1:1 and the days of Genesis. Sometimes it's a focus on the author, and then 20th, thematic studies are to be found as well. And the only example I brought you here, I have Woodstra's The Ark of the Covenant, From Conquest to Kingship. Now, if you're studying an Old Testament text that deals with the Ark of the Covenant, it'd be good for you to know as much as you can about the Ark, because it goes beyond just one book of the Bible or one setting historically. And so here's a study of that in the Ark, of course. You're not going to have particular studies on everything you read about in the Bible, but certain things have great theological significance, and this is one of them. So let's just review very quickly then, going down to the smallest little thing up to, you know, the grandest hermeneutical broad perspective, and then how it gets detailed from that point on. You need to do translation comparisons. You need to go to the original text. For many of you, that means interlinear translations. Then you need to understand from analytical lexicons and parsing guides the grammatical forms and functions. Fourthly, you need to read in grammars what those forms and functions are all about. Fifthly, lexicons tell you the semantic meaning and variations for words. Sixthly, cross-reference systems and sometimes harmonies will help you see how words are used in significant other texts. Seventhly, idioms, synonyms, and phrase books talk about standardized uses and functions that are found in a linguistic community. Eighthly, concordances show you all of the uses of a word. Hebrew, Greek, and English concordances should be consulted. Ninthly, theological word books expand beyond this and talk about the theology of the various words and the significance they have across history and cross-culturally. Tenthly, Septuagintal tools show you how you can study a text, a term, a concept from the Old Testament as it comes into the New, or vice versa, background for New Testament terms. Eleventhly, Bible dictionaries and encyclopedias, which you already are familiar with in English, go into the background of people and concepts and places and events. Twelfth, we can get more detail on the place and the time of things from atlases and chronologies. 13th, archaeological